The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
The biggest disappointment for me personally is seeing people who go to a lawyer, whether young or old, for representation, and then are basically sold out because the lawyer is scared to go to trial, or the lawyer has a quota and he or she has to turn the case and settle it to make their own personal quota so that they make their money. And these clients that is the majority of what happens today.
Rich Newsom on the peril of sacrificing quality for quantity in a law practice. And the moment he decided to switch sides from defense to plaintiff.
You know, the family was crying. They had lost a two-year-old, and I'm trying, you know, to hold my emotions in check. And I, on the way home, I called my wife. We were pregnant with our first child and trying to build a house, still had student loans. I called her and said, I can't do this. Because I just felt this connection to this family. And I felt like I needed to be their advocate, not represent this big old giant corporation.
And on his public service and the need he sees for political moderation.
You know, I started out as a Republican, which is a weird thing for a trial lawyer because most trial lawyers are not Republicans. But then having come from that place as a young trial lawyer and having represented people, you realize that there are no black and whites. There are shades of gray. So I really today consider myself an independent.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I'm Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. Rich Newsom of Orlando has been at the center of some of the biggest personal injury cases involving automobiles in this century. He played a key role in convincing Congress to pass the TREAD Act. He also identified a quiet trend of settlements and seized on it, resulting in the recall of more than 100 million airbags, the largest recall in history. His love of law and exploration of innovative tactics among his peers led him to found a school for trial lawyers. He also served as president of the Florida Justice Association during a significant time of tort reform efforts in the Florida legislature. Rich Newsom sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in October of 2020 to talk about how he's tried to change the legal process for the better, how trial anxiety can become a lawyer's strength, and his greatest regret that he says he'll take to his grave.
Rich, you've made a name for yourself and your firm in product liability law, and especially regarding automobiles. Now, there's two big cases in particular. The first, the Ford Firestone case back in 2000, which resulted in what trial lawyers really aspire to, which is changing the laws of the land. Tell us about that case.
Yeah, so this is when I had just started to do plaintiff's work. I had actually come from defending Ford Motor Company. I was a federal prosecutor, and then I was with a big firm, and Ford was our big client, and really just didn't feel comfortable on that side. And so I joined a smaller firm and was representing people in these injury cases from defective products. And I was at a meeting in Washington, I think it was in Seattle. And it was a group of lawyers from around the country that were sharing information on tire cases and on seatbelt cases called the AIEG. And there was a breakout on tires this year. And a group of us had defective tire cases. We're going to meet and compare notes. And typically when you do this, there would be a show of hands. There was, I think, maybe 30 people who showed up, which was a really large number. Usually there'd be five or six of us. And there were like 30 or 40 people in this room. And someone went around as typical, who has a Cooper tire case? And there'd be two or three hands, and they'd meet and talk about Cooper tire cases. Who has a Continental case? Again, two, three hands. who has a Ford ATX Wilderness tire, and almost every single hand in the room went up. And everyone kind of looked at each other, and it was one of those moments. And this is before the media had gotten a hold of this thing. And so as the conversation went forward, we decided to start collecting information. We found about 50 or so cases where someone had been injured or killed from one of these Firestone Wilderness ATX tires. And a group of us got together, and we started to compare notes, and we decided to hire some consultants to start digging for more information because we felt that there was more to the story. And sure enough, there was. And from there, it became what ultimately at the time was the largest recall in history, and it resulted in the Tread Act, which is one of the most important pieces of safety legislation for the auto industry in my lifetime.
That's terrific. And you personally had several dozen clients as part of this, did you not?
Yeah, we did. There were class actions, of course, and there were what are referred to as by the class folks as single event cases. In other words, real cases where someone has been injured or killed or has had a family member killed as a result of one of these. And when we had probably 30 plus of these Firestone tire failure cases.
Mm. Your efforts in that case were recognized by the American Association for Justice, which awarded you the Stephen Sharp Award. Let's talk about your other big case, this one involving the Takata airbags installed on more than 34 million vehicles in the U.S. at one time in history. It was a case that dominated the headlines. Your client, he became the actual face of this national tragedy, didn't he, Corey Burdick?
Yeah, he is. Actually, it was closer to 100 million, actually, and growing still. It's been the largest recall in history. Yeah, so I got a call one day. I was in my office, and one of my neighbors, who's a plastic surgeon, called me and said, "Hey, Rich, don't you do airbag cases?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Well, I got a guy here. I just operated. I took a 3-inch metal shard out of his face." And I said, "Oh, my gosh, let me guess. He was driving a Honda." And he said, "Yeah, how'd you know?" So, again, because we do this stuff, there's a friend of mine who's a consultant said, "Look, be on the lookout. There have been a handful of these cases where this Takata airbag explodes and it's like a grenade and it sends shards of metal out, but they've all settled very quickly and quietly. So be on the lookout." And I hadn't had one. And then I got this call. And of course, none of this had been in the paper yet or the news media. And so we signed the guy up, super nice guy. His name was Corey Burdick. He became the poster child because we introduced him to Bill Nelson. And Bill Nelson was so angry when he heard the full story of what had happened and how many of these airbags potentially were still out there that he started to hold Senate hearings. He was chairman of the Commerce Committee in the United States Senate at the time, and he had our client come to Washington, and he talked about Corey on the Senate floor. And it ultimately resulted in the NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, getting involved, and eventually this massive recall. And really, again, it was one of those that I think changed the behavior of a lot of corporations. Most of the big manufacturers, most of the original equipment car companies were involved in this. And I think in the wake of that, it's caused car manufacturers and manufacturers in general just to be more careful. And I think to come to the realization that it's better to take the high road, to do the right thing, to recall early and often when you know about a safety problem.
Now, this case also required you to really kind of change the process of litigation as well. You had to get together with attorneys in other states, and you formed an actual state court coalition, didn't you? Tell us about that and why you did that and the impact that it's had beyond that case today.
Sure. So a lot of times whenever there's a big issue like this, there are not just the real injuries, the real families who have suffered, but there's this whole army of class action lawyers that get involved. And so after Bill Nelson held the hearings, and now it's, of course, on the front page of the newspapers and on the national news every night, the class action lawyers come along and they file these claims for property damage and loss of value of the vehicles. And all of a sudden, you've got 80 plus cases that are filed in federal court. And they want to have what's called an MDL, multi-district litigation. And we had seen this happen before. It happened in General Motors. With a General Motors issue, it happened with Toyota with an issue they had with regard to sudden acceleration. And actually what had happened, the trend was that these cases were ending up forcing the state court cases where real folks are injured to come to a halt. The plaintiffs committee and the manufacturer would come to state court where someone really had an injury and needed a trial date, and they'd say, stop the litigation. Wait until the MDL, till the class actions have finished, because of course there's more of them, and that's sort of the big engine that needs to drive this judge, and you need to pause your case. And it had worked. It had worked in the GM litigation. It had worked in some other cases. And so we saw this coming down the pike. And so I got together with Jim Perdue Jr., a great lawyer out in Houston, Rob Ammons, and a group of other lawyers. And we identified every single real injury case. And so we got together and decided that we needed to join forces, and we called it the Takata State Court Coalition. And we actually started to file notices of appearance collectively. Ted Leopold was involved in this too. And we were very effective in banding together and telling these state court judges that, look, we are together. You can still allow us to move forward. And the state court lawyers worked together to enable our cases to stay on track. The class actions lawyers did their thing, and it ended up working very, very well because there was a balance. That happened in Ford Firestone too, by the way. But it ended up having a nice ending in that the clients whose families and whose loved ones were really hurt and really injured ended up getting their justice and not having to wait until the end of the class action litigation.
Sure, sure. Now, just in 2019, fast forward about 4 or 5 years from that case, you were recognized by the National Law Journal for winning two of the nation's 100 largest verdicts in 2018. To date, you've had more than $500 million in verdicts and settlements. Rich, what is it that makes you so effective, do you think?
You know, I think a lot of it is just being willing to go to trial. Unfortunately, so much of the litigation that happens, especially in serious injury cases, when a defendant or an insurance company is coming in and offering, decent money, the cases are settled a lot of times because the trial lawyer may not have that much experience trying a big case because there's maybe a lot of costs involved. These cases are expensive. It's complex. It takes a lot of manpower. And sometimes, especially in the bigger cases where there's a complex issue, like a commercial truck, one of those cases was a commercial trucking case, or multiple defendants, it gets really expensive and hard because the other side is usually going to bring their A game. In other words, the insurance companies or the manufacturers or the trucking company is going to hire really good lawyers who will sometimes bury the plaintiff lawyer. And our firm is situated such that we're a boutique trial firm. In other words, we don't do volume. We don't have to represent hundreds of clients. We have that luxury that enables us to get ready. And so most of our work is done working with other law firms to help them try their cases. And so I think, again, just because of the way we have set up our firm and are willing to go to trial and not be in a position of weakness where because of costs or being outmanned, we have to settle for a cheaper number. And so we're able to go the distance and really, put the other side back on their heels, because we ended up burying them in paperwork and spending usually more money getting ready for trial than they do. And I think that's our advantage.
Gotcha. Rich, let's go back to the beginning now. You are a seventh generation Floridian. What were the most important influences in your life growing up?
Well, I had the good fortune to come from my mom and dad. My mom was a teacher, and her mother was a teacher. And my dad worked in construction, and we were always a family that was paycheck to paycheck, but had a lot of love in our family, and my mom and dad were always, always there for us. And so, yeah, I'm maybe seventh generation North Florida, but nobody in my family ever really had much money. And so, to me, it was that, I think, that background and that experience that of coming from a lower middle class family where we struggled to really appreciate my clients, because I am them, at least a lot of them have come from that same place. And so I think above all, it was just coming from a background of a family that worked hard, and had good values.
So you can relate to some of the very clients that you have represented.
Yeah. In fact, I was representing Ford Motor Company after I left the U.S. Attorney's Office, and there was a family that had lost a 2-year-old in an alleged defective seatbelt case. And I'm sitting there taking the depositions of the family members representing Ford. And the lawyer representing the family in this case was a really nice guy, but he was outgunned. I mean, we were burying this poor guy. And I just, you know, the family was crying. They had lost a 2-year-old, and I'm trying, you know, to hold my emotions in check. And I, on the way home, I called my wife. We were pregnant with our first child and trying to build a house, still had student loans. I called her and said, I can't do this, because I just felt this connection to this family. And I felt like I needed to be their advocate, not representing this big old giant corporation.
When you were growing up, before or during high school, did you have any interest in law or think you might get into law?
Yeah, I mean, not really. I mean, I had, you know, I used to read readings Sunday at church. You know, I did debate when I was in eighth grade, but when I was in 10th grade, I was talking to my dad, who I just loved dearly. And I said, hey, you know, what do you think I should be when I, you know, grow up and when I'm have to have a career choice? And he looked at me, and this guy's a construction guy, right? And he says, you know, I think you'd be a good lawyer. Mm-hmm. And it just felt good. It's like, wow, I could be a lawyer. So I think that was for sure the turning point that dictated my legal career.
Wow, you got a stamp of approval in a very big way.
Yeah. Well, felt good. You know, it felt right. And sometimes it works out.
So you were Florida State University double major, economics and politics, University of Florida Law School, graduated in 1989. Then as a fresh out, you became an assistant U.S. attorney in the Northern and Middle Districts of Florida, serving with unusual distinction. Tell us how that came about. That's quite a significant achievement for someone just out of law school.
Well, this is embarrassing to admit, but I was also working for the legislature at the time and had some friends who were pretty influential. And the guy who was the U.S. attorney in the Northern District wanted an appointment up in Washington. And so they encouraged him to hire me. And I was just an intern. I was literally a legal intern without a law degree. And so I got the job. He got the appointment. I got the job. I mean, it wasn't, you know, a quid pro quo, but it was certainly, and he liked me, and I, you know, was very earnest and had done some good things in law school. But yeah, so I started right out of the chute with the U.S. Attorney's Office and got an amazing opportunity to work under some brilliant lawyers, including Ken Sakaya, who was just one of the best appellate lawyers ever. I wrote a lot of briefs and then tried a lot of federal court cases and then got to argue my own appeals to the 11th Circuit. And having that opportunity to get that kind of experience as a young lawyer was just really an amazing way to start as a trial lawyer.
Rich, who was your mentor?
I've had several. I really had the good fortune to have been right out of the chute taught how to write by Ken Sakaya, who's one of the best appellate lawyers around. Greg Miller, who ultimately became the U.S. attorney, really helped me learn how to try cases. Then when I was with the defense firm, even though it was on the other side of what I do now, Ron Cabanis, who at the time was this sort of swashbuckling former Marine fighter pilot who was Ford's big case trial guy. They would drop him in to these really what they call their blockbuster cases all around the country where they'd have huge exposure. And so Ron met me and actually hired me to work with him because I had some trial experience and I was still young, and we actually shared a paralegal, and he was just an incredibly wonderful influence. But my heart wasn't in it. I loved Ron. He was a great guy, but golly, I just really felt an affinity and a connection to the people that were on the other side of Ford. And then left him after not too terribly long and was with a guy named John Overchuck, who was another just great mentor on the plaintiff side. So I've really had just a string of great lawyers to look up to and learn from that just, I think, was a really rare gift as a trial lawyer.
So today you are senior partner of what you have described as a boutique law firm, 9-member Newson Melton Law Firm, which has been consistently recognized as among the best in the U.S. Rich, what are some of your lessons and tips for building and running a law firm? Because a lot of good lawyers aren't necessarily good managers or good business people.
Well, unfortunately, I'm not a good business manager or business person either. I wish I was a little more like my friend John Morgan, who is brilliant at that. I'm just a trial lawyer, and I've got the good fortune to have a younger partner, Frank Melton, who runs our firm. But I think, at least for me, my whole job has just been to try to win cases, to try to be good in the courtroom. And, you know, I'll certainly not be the wealthiest guy, but man, I've enjoyed what I've done. And I've had the chance to not just try cases, but also to study the art, to really try to learn from other great trial lawyers, to travel around the country, to meet with people, to talk, to take, you know, I did this, the trial lawyers college, the Jerry Spence School, you know, several years ago.
Yes.
So, you know, I think for me, that's just been my whole deal. I'm a trial lawyer. I love the art of it. I love the craft, and I love the community. I just really love other plaintiff trial lawyers. They're these wonderful, entrepreneurial, passionate men and women who care about people and are the warriors for them to try to help make their lives better. And so, all the way around, that's been kind of my mission and my feel-good place.
Well, and I was going to say, along the way, you founded your own unique finishing school, so to speak, for trial lawyers called Trial Schools Incorporated. Tell us how you came to that concept and to go forward on that.
So I had grown up as a civil trial lawyer on the plaintiff's side under a guy named Jay Burke, who has really coached a lot of the best trial lawyers around the state. Keith Mitnick, he's helped Willie Gary, Chris Searcy, Jared. And Jay had this method of picking juries that he called causes king. And so several years ago, I went to the Jerry Spence Trial Lawyers College out in Wyoming, and it's this amazing experience. You spend 3 weeks with no cell phone and no computer on Jerry's ranch, and you learn. And Spence had this completely different approach. Now, he's in a really red Republican jurisdictions, unlike Florida, which is kind of mixed, and some laws that don't necessarily allow challenges for cause. And so Spence has this method he called tribe building, which is 180 degrees different from what we had done here in Florida. And I really couldn't get my mind around it. And so I asked a group of lawyers to get together, some of the senior people from the Trial Lawyers College, some of the senior guys around some of the best, you know, Mitnick and Brian McLean and Alex Alvarez, some other folks from around Florida. And we mashed up over the course of 3 or 4 days, focus groups where one lawyer would use one method and then another would use the next. And we got to see, we sat in a room and we watched. There's like 30 of us from around the country. And it was really insightful. And what at least for me, and I think most of us realize that there are more methods than one. And so it's kind of like when the Ultimate Fighting Championship started in the early 90s, there were these different methods. There was karate and jiu-jitsu and boxing. And ultimately today, you've got to be proficient in all of them, because what we know from martial arts, mixed martial arts or MMA, is that you've got to be proficient in all of the methodologies. And to be able to combine them together based upon the situation and based on your personal, you know, affinities or skills. And so I think it's the same thing. So trial school started initially as a laboratory to try to understand how to combine method for first voir dire. And then we started doing opening statements and then closing statements. Then we got some of the Summit Council. The Summit Council is a group that I'm in for a really amazing, so truly, I think, the best lawyers today, the guys who are actually in the courtroom today trying cases, guys like Troy Rafferty and Purdue, sure. Jim Purdue Jr. and some others. And so we started bringing it all together and curating these various methods. And today, 3 years later, it's been this incredible exercise for me personally to try to improve, I think, my skills. But then we're also giving it away. We decided, hey, let's make this a not-for-profit and change the way we do CLE. And if we're going to curate and build these great sort of methods, you know, combining how to do a closing and opening, why don't we give it away and make it in a format that's easy and free, as long as you represent only people. So in other words, if you represent an insurance company or you're a prosecutor, you are absolutely not allowed in. But if you're pure and you only represent people, we're going to give it away. And it's just been a labor of love. And it's made me just a crazy better in terms of what I'm able to do for my clients in the courtroom.
That is terrific. And what a lasting legacy, too, because I'm sure that thing now has real legs going forward.
Yeah, I mean, we've got right around 3,000 members and growing members around the country. We've got a really super active listserv. We've got this growing library. We do workshops, free workshops, and it's just growing. I mean, it's been unbelievable how it's taken off.
Now, along the way in your career, you also made time to serve as you mentioned, in the legislature on staff initially, but then you're also a past president of the Florida Justice Association. As a matter of fact, your term was 2010 through 2011, which was a big year for tort reform. That was a significant year. Tell us about that one.
It was awful. I was elected based upon, we thought that there was going to be one guy who was going to be the Senate president. It was going to be this easy year. Well, our guy didn't win. And so by the time I got to be president, we had, for the first time, super majorities that were elected in the House and the Senate, and a very tort reform minded governor in Rick Scott. And it was about 6 months before I took office, I was with one of my friends at a football game who was a lobbyist for the insurance industry. And he said, "Yeah, so when are you going to be president?" I said, "In 6 months." And he looked at me, and this guy's a really good friend. He goes, "Don't do it." I'm like, "What are you talking about?" He goes, "Pick another year." I'm like, "Why? What are you talking about?" I could feel the sweat breaking out. You know, how you feel that this. And he said, "Well, you know," and he had, of course, had a bunch of cocktails at this point and shouldn't have told me this. He goes, "Well, we are planning the chamber and the companies we've gotten together. This is the year. It's going to be worse than Texas for you guys." Now, Texas had had tort reform several years before, and it had eviscerated the civil justice system. Medical malpractice cases were almost impossible. Mm. Everything from workers' compensation to you name it. And so when he told me that, I'm like, "Oh my gosh." And sure enough, they filed 26 bills, and but for Jeff Porter and a wonderful staff with Paul Jess, I mean, truly we pulled the rabbit out of the hat. But it was really touch and go. And until the very closing minutes, I was up in the gallery with my friend Troy Rafferty from the great Levin Papantonio firm, and sure, Jeff Porter, sure, and Fred Cunningham. And man, it was nip and tuck, but we got past it. Thank goodness, with only minor damage. Actually, my practice, product liability, got hurt, but we dodged a bullet. But it was a really tough time electorally, trying to raise money, trying to keep our troops and our friends and our members together. But we made it through. But it was a really stressful, awful time for me.
Sure. Well, Rich, how has your involvement with the Florida Justice Association impacted your career as a trial lawyer?
You know, the FJA for me has been like family. So when I left the civil defense side and joined the plaintiff side, I didn't know very much about how to be a plaintiff lawyer. I mean, I could try cases, but they just opened their arms and embraced me, both in terms of friendships, guys like Fred Cunningham, who I've known now for, gosh, it's unbelievable, more than 20 years, and Mike Haggard and Gary Farmer and these great lawyers that on a personal level I've gotten really close. He's got, you know, it's like it's the band of brothers and sisters that just has really been meaningful personally, but professionally their CLE programs and the things that they taught me as a young plaintiff lawyer was just game changer. And then of course the blood that they have left on the field from having fought and basically kept the courthouse doors open for all of our clients and all of the people who are aggrieved by negligence or wrongdoing by corporate misconduct. But for the FJA here in Florida, we wouldn't have opportunities as citizens to have redress for these kinds of cases. So to me, it's the most important organization that I've ever been a member of.
Well, and also you've put your politics degree to good use as well throughout your law career. You were selected, for example, to help Florida's Attorney General take on the opioid manufacturers to recoup millions of taxpayer dollars, literally to spend fighting our state's opioid epidemic that continues to this day as we record this. You also served on the State Constitutional Revision Commission in 2016, a group that only meets once but every 20 years. You've managed to work along the way with both Democrats and Republicans. How have you done that?
Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, I started out as a Republican, which is a weird thing for a trial lawyer because most trial lawyers are not Republicans. But then having come from that place as a young trial lawyer and having represented people, you realize that there are no black and whites. There are shades of gray. So I really today consider myself an independent because, you know, we see such divisiveness today in the country, and I think it's ripping us apart. But most people just really want to raise their kids. They want to make a living, and they don't care about these extremist positions. And unfortunately, I think our whole political system has become so infected. And when you're able to to really try to just do what's right for the people, be it Republican or Democrat. I consider myself a moderate, and I see good in both parties. And so for me, I think to really look, that's probably why I could never run for office, though, because right. I am sort of in the middle. But it's unfortunate, because I think that for most Americans, more moderation and more working across the aisle would be so much better for so many reasons, and bring in unity and all the things we see every day. Sure. It's just heartbreaking.
Well, for young lawyers who may be listening to this program right now, what words of wisdom have proven true to you along the way, along your path in law?
I think if you're going to be a trial lawyer, you need to try cases. The biggest disappointment for me personally is seeing people who go to a lawyer, whether they're young or old, for representation, and then are basically sold out because the lawyer is scared to go to trial, or the lawyer has a quota and he or she has to turn the case and settle it to make their own personal quota so that they make their money. And these clients that is the majority of what happens today. This is a very different world even from when I started doing plaintiffs work, 20 plus years ago. And I think that's the biggest disappointment. I think a lot of clients are just railroaded by lawyers, understandably, who have way too many cases and aren't in a position where they can take a case to trial to get full justice. So that to me is the greatest problem in our industry. So for a young lawyer, my advice would be figure out a way that you don't have to be beholden to a quota, or also such that you can get away from your fear. And that's one of the things we've tried to do in trial school. The big gorilla in the room, or the elephant in the room rather, is that most lawyers are scared to try cases. It's performance anxiety. It's fearful that if you lose, golly, maybe you're a small practitioner and you're going to go bankrupt. Whatever it is, you've got to address that fear so that when you walk into the court, first of all, so you're not going to sell out your client. But second, such that when you go in the courtroom and you're talking in front of a jury, your fear doesn't overwhelm you, and you can just think about connecting to the jury and speaking as the voice of your client. But fear, that's the big one right now. And so one of the things we've been talked about, there are methods to overcoming it. Absolutely methods that work. And so that's my second piece of advice. A, try cases. Don't sell out your client. B, figure out a way to deal with your fear. So,
do you still get nervous before a trial?
Every time. I was talking to Mitnick about this. Mitnick was like, I don't get, nervous, blah, blah. It's like, I do. I get eaten alive by anxiety. I worry so much about the outcome of a trial for so many levels. I worry about my client, what's going to happen to him. I worry about, just personally, I hate losing. And so, and it's one of the things I want to talk about it in trial school. I get performance anxiety big time. I get nervous as hell. I'm eaten up the night before, but I think that can be your strength. And as long as you recognize it and embrace it, it can become your biggest weapon. Even be honest with the jury. I got cottonmouth a couple of years ago in a case. I told the jury, look, I'm sorry. I'm really nervous right now. I've been doing this, almost 30 years. So I embrace it. I'm honest about it. And I think it can really help. As long as you're willing to address it and be honest about it, I think it can help you in the end.
Notwithstanding everything that you've just said, this is a tough profession. Complex cases, a lot of hard work, a lot of time. Rich, how do you balance your professional life with your family life?
I think I'm in a unique situation. Most young lawyers who are becoming trial lawyers today have volume to deal with. I have the luxury of not having to have volume. And it's just because of the way my career path has taken me that most of my cases come from referrals. Now, I'm clearly not making as much money, and I'm a terrible businessman, but I'm able to concentrate on the clients that I have, work them up for trial, try them, and feel good about the work product that we're doing. And because I don't have to handle volume, it gives me enough time to be able to spend time with my family and to go home most times, with a reasonable hour and be home for dinner. Now, around trial time, no, that's a different deal. That's game on. You're working, 80 plus hours a week. But most, that's a minority of the actual time, especially lately with COVID. We haven't been trying any cases.
Sure.
But yeah.
What about regrets?
Oh, boy. My biggest regret, no question, is a case I tried up in the Panhandle. It was a case involving a 19-year-old paraplegic. And I was so cocky. I had never lost a case at that point. And I went into there just so sure I was going to win. And it was the hubris, thinking I knew how to do it. And I was actually, I had Jay Burke was my jury consultant. He told me what a great job I did picking the jury, And when the jury came back with a goose egg, when we got poured out, defense verdict, I was devastated. And it hurt and it left a mark. And for, I mean, I lost my nerve trying cases. And now in retrospect, having, you know, went back eventually and licked my wounds and studied the art, and I figured out what I did wrong. And the good news is those losses and that heartache and that regret ended up transforming me into an eminently better trial lawyer. I know I wouldn't have, well, knock on wood, you never know. I don't think I would have lost that case today. So, but boy, I'll never forget it. And poor, of course, for that client, that poor young man, he's never going to get the justice he deserves. So I'll take that one to my grave.
Rich, how would you like to be remembered?
Well, first, as a good husband and a good father. That's, of course, you know, when I went to the Spence College, they asked, you know, who are you and what do you want to do for the rest of your life? You know, and you have to go somewhere on the ranch and think about it, and you watch the sun come up on the mountain, and then you have to share it with everyone. And when I came back, for me, it was pretty self-evident after thinking about it, which I never thought about. So, yeah, I'm a family guy. I just am. That's kind of my happy place, is my wife, who's awesome, who totally puts up with me and has been my rock. And my three great kids. But, you know, after that, I would hope to be thought of as, in terms of any, you know, my kids look back and what did dad do? You know, I would like to be thought, have them think that I was a multiplier. In other words, that I took my career to A, help other people by trying cases, but even more than that, is to share it and to help not just me and my clients, but maybe help other trial lawyers, guys, you know, and women who are scared and fearful. Because I am there still, I get afraid. But how do we deal with that? And how do we turn that into a strength? And how do we get better? How do we take these lessons that not just me, but these amazing lawyers who are on the trial school faculty from across the country, guys like Mike Kelly, and Purdue and Joe Freed, these amazing, and how do we curate that and present it for free to lawyers who can't afford to go to a fancy conference up in Las Vegas or in Atlanta and take a week off of work, to curate that and make it available so that we can multiply those experiences and help others, other lawyers, so they don't lose those cases and their clients open. So that again, very long answer, but I'd like to be thought of as a multiplier who's not just helped my clients, but hopefully helped others with their clients too.
Rich Newsom, you are a titan of trial. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, my friend. This has been fun.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.